You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Sports Tours International. If you want to ride the Étape du Tour or watch the pros take part in the Tour de France, Sports Tours International can give you the VIP treatment and the trip of a lifetime. If you're taking part in the Étape, all you have to do is ride, because before and after the event, Sports Tours International's experienced guides will take care of you and your bike. If you choose the Étape du Tour VIP trip, you'll stay at the luxury Hotel Radiana, which has a spa package included, and that will help you with your post-ride recovery. There's also a celebration reception after the event where you can swap stories of your heroics on the bike with your fellow riders. As for the Tour de France, Sports Tours International's team of guides know the race inside out. They've been taking people to watch the biggest bike race in the world for years, and they can help you get the most out of the experience, taking care of all of the logistics and getting you where you need to be so you get a front row seat of the greatest race. In fact, there are so many customers who return year after year because of the knowledge and expertise of Sports Tours International's guides. Whether you want to go to the Grand Départ weekend or Mont Ventoux, the Pyrenees or the Alps, or even just a final stage in Paris to see it all conclude on the Champs-Élysées, Sports Tours International know France and the Tour inside out. There's a range of packages to suit every cycling fan, so if you want to see the race up close from the roadside, go to sportstoursinternational.co.uk for all of the details. Don't just watch the Tour this summer, watch it live. Book your place now with Sports Tours International and be part of the adventure of a lifetime.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and joining you on February the 12th, 2025. That is 20 years to the day after the controversial Lance Armstrong's one-word answer of yes to a question posed by Oprah Winfrey on her eponymous chat show caused a sensation in the sporting world. That question being whether he would go for a seventh Tour de France title. My name is Daniel Freiber. I am the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we will discuss present day occurrences in the world of professional cycling, including the Tour of Oman, the beef at the Étoile de Bessèges last week, and also a heartening weekend for Colombian riders. Joining me to do that today are the usually, I stress usually, non-controversial Rob Hatch.
Hello.
And the slightly more belligerent Lionel Burney.
Well, can I just ask whether that Armstrong interview with Oprah Winfrey was the first most famous or the second most famous of the interviews that he did with Oprah Winfrey?
Well,
not
now
the one
it's
that
definitely
would have immediately
second.
Leapt to my mind.
Well, I expected an early corrections corner when I said 20 years. But yes, it was 20 years to the day, chaps. These are the depths I go to find tangential notes upon which to start these podcasts. Yes, that was an appearance.
You've not been busy then this week, have you?
Last 20 minutes, I've been pretty busy. That was an appearance with his then partner, Sheryl Crow, on the Oprah Winfrey Show on February the 12th, I believe, 2005. Anyway, chaps, how are we doing?
Very well, thank you. Yes. Gosh, 20 years ago, I think that's probably when I stopped believing in fairy tales. Or what was it? Was it fairy tales? No, it wasn't fairy tales, was it? What was it? What was he said on the podium?
I think it was fairy tales, wasn't it? Miracles?
Miracles.
That's right. I stopped believing in miracles in July 2005.
Fellas, I said we will be concentrating on the present day. There will be controversy, but I think that will be the last mention of the controversial Lance Armstrong this week's podcast. You never know, however. As always, we're going to start the episode with our regular feature, which still doesn't have a regular name, the news bring and buy, I referred to it as a couple of weeks ago, where we all bring a news item that has caught our attention over the last week. I'm going to start this week. I'm going to open the batting. Tadej Pogacar has been in the news because of his output on social media. He was filmed last week doing a recon of the Arenberg Forest. Of course, Arenberg Forest, iconic location in Paris-Roubaix. We didn't expect Paris-Roubaix to be on his race program this year. We still don't really expect it to be on his race program this year. So what on earth was he doing? Well, we know that he was on a recon with Tim Wellens. They went to recon the Tour of Flanders course. Of course, Pog is riding Flanders this year. But, chaps, and I want to hear what you think of this. Was he merely sprinkling some mischief with that video of him looking very good, it must be said, on the Arenberg Forest? 1.1 million people watched the video in the first hour. Couple of footnotes, couple of caveats I will add. In 2022, he also, I don't know whether it was a selfie or someone took a photo of him also on the Paris-Roubaix route. He also did a recon that year and he didn't ride the race. Of interest to me as well was the choice of music. Drake's Push-Ups. This in a week when Drake, the Canadian rapper's career was pretty much finished by his longtime rival Kendrick Lamar in the halftime show in the Super Bowl. Of course, they've had a very long-running beef, those two, but Kendrick Lamar very much coming out on top at the moment. So curious choice to go with a Drake song for that video. I did request a comment from Tadej Pogacar's official social media spokesperson, manager, shall we say, whose identity cannot be revealed. The reply was, "Everything we do is layered and cryptic, Daniel. It's all part of the magic," with a wand emoji. So, Pog to Paris-Roubaix, yes or no?
Well, one day, but maybe not this year. It would be great, wouldn't it, if this was kind of the seeing round corners double bluff and he was getting us all on strings. But I'm sure he'll do it one day. I mean, he's done the junior event a couple of times way back, obviously, when he was a junior. And it's going to become a sort of gap in his palmares. And clearly he fancied it. But for the time being, he can get us all speculating, can't he? I would say he probably won't do it this year, but I'd love to be surprised and proved wrong. He's doing a lot of other classics, isn't he? So it would fit right in.
I get the feeling he wants to do it. I also get the feeling that his team probably doesn't want him to do it. There's that lingering fear around Paris-Roubaix, isn't there? Because of the fact that it is the race that it is and there is the danger that there is. I have a feeling he really wants to do it. But again, you know, he doesn't just choose his own race program, I'm sure.
Can I ask about the filming?
Because yes.
Was it really Tim Wellens who was doing the filming, riding alongside him at the same pace? Because it was incredibly steady footage. Clearly, Tim Wellens was going
because
well
he was off
well.
To the, but he was off the cobbles maybe on the side. Is it not a little
possible? Yeah, possible.
Servis Carnarvon, ex-Paris-Roubaix winner, was very doubtful. He was quoted, I think, in La Gazzetta dello Sport, very sceptical that Pog was just doing it for fun, for the vibes. He thinks that if Pogacar is riding Arenberg Forest on February the 9th, it's because he's going to ride Paris-Roubaix this year.
Wait, not too fast.
Tadej Pogacar, the Drake of the cycling world. Does that mean that Jonas Vingegaard is the Kendrick Lamar of proceedings? We shall find out at the Tour de France in July, maybe. Who's going next?
I'm going to go next because I have no idea about who you're talking about there. I want to touch on a more serious matter, and I was delighted at the start of the year when Merhawi Kudus came back to real professional cycling. He was not given a new contract by EF Education Easy Post a couple of years ago after 2 years there. Talking about a former winner of the Tour de Rwanda, a rider who's been up there in Grand Tours. Remember the Vuelta, he was on the attack. I think it was down in the Levante region at one point, almost winning a stage. He's had a very good career so far. Dimension Data, Astana before that. But he had to go down to the third division last year to Terengganu in Malaysia. I mean, they are the top team in Asia. They have been for a long, long time. But he worked his way back to a contract and was signed by Burgos Bh, the second division Spanish team, obviously hoping to ride the Vuelta a España and go back to Grand Tour racing. It would be a 10th Grand Tour for him if he was to take that on. But he started his season in Mallorca very, very solid there. Unfortunately, news came out quite a few days after the fact this week in the Spanish press that he had a very bad fall, unfortunately, when riding for Burgos Bh at Grand Prix Cycliste in Marseille. It was such a bad fall that I'm afraid he's got some pretty serious injuries, and the news only didn't come out for a few days after because the team was struggling to contact his family in Eritrea and give them the news. He's been in a hospital in France. This week, they're hoping to move him to a hospital in Burgos in northern Spain. And I can tell you that the medical report at the moment is that there are rib fractures, fractures of the vertebra, also the tailbone, as well as injuries on the lungs, including, unfortunately, a pneumothorax. So that is a shocking start to life back in the second division for Merhawi Kudus. And I hope that he has a speedy recovery as possible. We can see him back in action the second part of the year, because a rider like that, given a bit of freedom, pure climbers and an exciting rider to watch.
Get well soon. Kudus.
Yeah, well, leading on from that, really, someone who can empathise with Merhawi Kudus's situation at the moment and his injuries, and perhaps provide a bit of inspiration for a full recovery, is Egan Bernal, who won his first races this week since the 2021 Giro d'Italia. He put on Exodus. 1,347 days have passed since winning the Giro. Before he won then the Colombian Time Trial Championships, and he then followed that by winning the road race. So he's won a couple of races in quick succession. Of course, Bernal had that terrible crash in training in his home country, Colombia, in January 2022, didn't he, when he was training and crashed into a bus, which was stationary at the time. And he suffered very serious injuries. You were listing Merhawi Kudus's injuries there, very similar injuries that Bernal suffered, fractured his right femur, his right kneecap, ribs, vertebra, punctured his lung, really serious injuries. And there was worries at the time whether he would recover even to ride a bike competitively again. He has, of course, come back, ridden the Tour de France a couple of times, 29th last year being his best result in a Grand Tour since his comeback. And he had quite an encouraging opening 10 or 12 days of the Tour, didn't he? He was lying 13th overall after the Plaid a Day stage. But for any rider, especially a Grand Tour champion, actually getting over the line first and winning a race is significant. I would suggest, after that length of time without a win. Obviously, you don't cross the line first in a time trial, but winning the road race, he achieved that. Perhaps wasn't the strongest possible field, because there wasn't Santiago Buitrago. He's been racing elsewhere. No Dani Martinez or Sergio Higuita or Esteban Chavez or even Nairo Quintana. But nevertheless, victory for Egan Bernal, and perhaps we will see him win more races this season in his Colombian national champions jerseys for Ineos Grenadiers. So Egan Bernal, perhaps on the way back. Still only 28, I think.
Young Egan Bernal.
Time yet. Can I just say, Daniel, a suggestion for this segment, the Musette of News, or the Newsette? You're wincing.
I don't know. We'll have a think about that, Lionel. We'll think about that long and hard.
You're too intelligent. For wordplay, aren't you, Daniel? Wordplay is beneath you.
That'll be raised in disgust at great length in next week's board meeting. Rob, you mentioned, I think, in your commentary in Valencia last week, we'll talk about...
you were listening. Oh,
yes,
dear.
I was. We will talk about the Vuelta Valenciana in part two, I believe. But I think you mentioned that it was over 200 days since Ineos Grenadiers had won a race. I think they're...
I think I'll be honest here, Daniel. I might have had a heads up on that.
I think their latest race win had been in the Tour of Austria last year, way back last July, Tour of Austria. So Egan Bernal's double victory in Colombia ended a very long drought. I've just had a message as well, chaps, on Twitter. This had escaped my attention. I don't know if you were across this, that Ineos recently parted ways with Ben Ainsley, who's not a cyclist. He's a sailor. What do you call them? Yachtsman. Boat person. Not a boat person. You know, he does the America's Cup. Ineos have pulled out of sailing is what I'm trying to say. And ooh. I've been asked by one of my followers, Ian, on Twitter, whether this could presage the end of Ineos' involvement in other sports, i.e. cycling. Also, we know that they've been cutting wages at Manchester United recently.
Daniel, they've also, I believe, the New Zealand Rugby federation governing body who has a sponsorship deal with Ineos have indicated they're going to start legal proceedings to recover unpaid sponsorship money. So, interesting times at Ineos. But Rob, I was listening to your commentary as well, and your co-commentator
was
Steve Cummings, wasn't it? Who, of course, had left Ineos and is now at Jayco Alula as a sports director. And I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall to just see what the facial expression was when you were talking about how long it's been since Ineos have won a race. I'm being slightly mischievous there, but interesting.
Ineos still sponsoring the seats, those sort of airport lounge style seats on the bench at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, the home of the Soccer Turkeys, the small chicken club.
This pains you almost as much as the idea of calling this segment the Newsette or the Newsette of News. Shall we crack on with the rest of the cycling podcast?
Yes, please.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by NordVPN. Now, there's never been a better time to get a VPN subscription, and NordVPN is the VPN of choice. Certainly, as far as I'm concerned, I've been using it for a number of years, and the primary advantage is the online safety and security that it offers. So wherever I am, whenever I'm online, I know that all of my sensitive data, like bank details, passwords, and even my online identity are safe and secure. And you can protect all of your devices, up to 10 devices, in fact, or do as I do, which is connect up your Wi-Fi router to NordVPN, and you know that every device that you're using at home is protected. Of course, when you're on the move and you're logging into Wi-Fi here, there, and everywhere, perhaps in hotels or tethering up to your mobile phone to get online, NordVPN really comes into its own then. And if you want to watch sporting events, TV shows, your favourite films, when you're out of the country, you can switch your virtual location and carry on watching the stuff you've subscribed to uninterrupted. It's also really fast. NordVPN says it's the fastest in the world, so there's no buffering or lagging when you're trying to stream watching your favourite sporting events. So NordVPN can offer you a great discount. Go to nordvpn.com/TCP, and that link will give you 4 months extra free when you purchase a 2-year plan. It's risk-free as well because they offer a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if in the unlikely event you don't see the benefit of NordVPN, you can get your money back. That link will be in the podcast episode show notes. Go to nordvpn.com/TCP for your exclusive cycling podcast deal today. Try it risk-free with the 30-day money-back guarantee.
Well, chaps, following on, speaking of football, we've all been tuned into our dodgy streams this morning, our moody streams, in this case, of the Tour of Oman. It was an official stream, wasn't it? But it's the official organisation stream. That is an event that is not being televised on any of the usual broadcast services. We've all been watching the decisive stage this morning. Would either of you like to tell the listeners or anyone who didn't see it what we were all watching? What happened?
I did manage to learn this morning that the phrase meter by meter is the same in Arabic as it is in English. That is the only phrase I think I understood from that wonderfully charged commentary that I enjoyed listening to this morning on Oman Sports TV. And if anyone's wondering, by the way, Tour of Oman's never been made available for international broadcast. That's why we were watching that on that stream today.
I facetiously said moody stream. This was all completely above board, legitimate. No VPNs were used in the making of...
It was on YouTube. I mean, without getting too into the detail, I mean, there are reasons why the Omani officials, government, what have you, don't want the race to be broadcast live, I guess. Don't want helicopter shots of their wider territory, perhaps. I understand, I gather, I speculate. But it was old school race coverage, wasn't it? Sort of single camera coverage on the front of the race, but we did see more or less, if you squinted, you could see what was going on. It was great sports broadcasting for the 21st century. The kids will be loving it on YouTube.
There will be a broadcast that's made, a highlights show that's made. It comes from it's made by people who have relations with AS. So I went 10 years ago to the Tour of Oman, actually, and it's an interesting, you get the footage, everyone's sitting around in a room in the hotel that's been commandeered and it's got loads of edit equipment in, and, you know, then editor will put 26 minutes of footage together or whatever it is to make the broadcast, and then you go back and then sort of mock the commentary up as live.
In 1972, I asked either or both of you, what happened in this race? Can someone please tell me?
Well, I'm happy to go. Adam Yates won for the second year in a row overall, didn't he? We had quite a thrilling final stage there on Green Mountain, a very brown Green Mountain. And it was a sort of three-way battle, wasn't it, between David Goddou, who was in the red leader's jersey this morning, Valentin Paré-Peintre, who is now with Soudal Quick-Step and was riding very well. He won the stage, Paré-Peintre, but Adam Yates did enough to take the overall lead and final race victory from David Goddou. And if I just recap what happened in the previous four stages, well, Olav Koy off to a flying start this season for Visma Lisa Bike. He won two flat stages. Luis Vaveca of Soudal Quickstep won a stage as well, and David Goddou took that race lead with victory on the third stage. So a victory for Adam Yates there, did exactly what he needed to do to win it overall. Possibly wasn't that bothered about the stage win, but to be fair, didn't look like he had an answer to Paré-Peintre at the finish there. And it's going to be a long old summer for Adam Yates, isn't it? Because he is slated to do both the Giro d'Italia and the Tour de France for UAE Team Emirates XRG. And he did make a comment, didn't he, saying that he needs to be good for a long period of time this summer, because he's going to be going into the Giro with overall hopes and the Tour as one of Tadej Pogacar's key support riders. So off to a winning start. Anything else stand out for you?
Yeah, something stood out for me. First ever pro win for Louis Vervaeke. 31 years of age. He was sort of hailed as this big talent when he came along at Lotto over a decade ago now. He was the latest Eddy Merckx. He was going to win stage race. He was going to do this. He was going to do that. He was going to go for GC. Didn't like the pressure. Really, really struggled with that. Talented bike rider.
I remember as well, he was quite candid at one point early in his career about how much he'd been affected by his parents separating at around about that time when he turned professional. Mm. And this really set him back a year or two.
He, just before he turned pro, he won a stage of the Tour de l'Avenir, and that was up on high at La Toussuire in southeast France. Obviously, Belgian media are going to get hold of that. And this is pre-Remco Evenepoel as well. This is when they've been a long, long time without any sort of stage race success at the highest level in, you know, big, big three-week races for Belgium. And he's become a domestique in the last few years, a really, really good one. And it was just so nice to see him get that moment himself. And he took his first ever pro win over a decade after turning pro. So well done, proficiat, Louis Vervaeke.
And chaps, that was a hell of a tussle, wasn't it, today on Green Mountain? A sort of rematch of, and I'm not a rugby fan, but a rematch of the fixture the French refer to as a Le Crunch, which happened at the weekend, I believe. The French against the English. I believe the English won by 1 point. I thought that it was going to be, well, as I say, a rematch of Le Crunch, mainly between Goddou and Yates, certainly for the general classification, but I'd kind of overlooked Paré-Peintre in my reckoning. He'd finished second on that stage behind Vaveca, Rob, and won the sprint, won quite a big bunch sprint behind Vaveca. And just reading the quotes after that stage, I think Vaveca himself said that, well, if Valentin is winning sprints, that must mean he's absolutely on top form. And indeed, Paré-Peintre has talked about that, the fact that he's probably not quite yet good enough. Of course, he's joined that team this year. He's not quite good enough to contend in the biggest races against the biggest riders. But in February, he's got his opportunity to go for a stage win, go for a race win, and that is what he intended to do. And he said he'd been riding recently, he's come out of the winter really well, he's been riding as well as he was when he won a stage at the Giro d'Italia last year. So not that surprising in that respect. And then Goddou, Salt Bay, as we affectionately nicknamed him at the Vuelta last year, and he's still sporting the same coiffure, isn't he? And sporting, I don't know, he's still sporting Salt Bae glasses on his way to sign on every morning. But he has also been talking quite bullishly about this season. He's going to ride the Giro this year, isn't he? He's going to go for GC in the Giro, yep. I believe.
And then I think stage wins at the Tour. That was the chat anyway.
Yeah, and he sort of toyed with Adam Yates on the previous uphill finish and beat him. But today, we saw him struggling, didn't we, to hold onto the coattails of the other two. And it looked as though he might just do it. But in the last kilometre, they pulled away. And in the end, he conceded quite a lot of time. Didn't completely explode, didn't completely capitulate. And I suppose it will still go down as a positive week for him. But disappointing nonetheless not to be able to hold on, particularly against Yates, who, as you said, Lionel, he, in contrast to Paris-Peintre, he's been talking about how he's kind of undercooked at this point and was going to just sort of try to eke out what he could at this point in the season.
Yeah, Salt Bae, I mean, a cracking 8-year-old cultural reference there, I think. Is that right? David Gordeau, that's because of the...
Oh, my
That's
God.
Because of the Rob's doing the little... I mean, we're going to have to explain this, aren't we? He's doing the little the seasoning. It was a sort of a meme, wasn't it? A chef that cooks his steak in a particular way.
Well, he covers it in sort of stuff to...
All comprehensively explained last year on the cycling podcast.
Yes, I know. Just thinking back to last year and Valentin Paris-Peintre, I mean, his stage win at the Giro last year, I can't remember where
down
it finished,
south.
But it was the one that started at Pompeii, wasn't it? Down Naples way, Napoli way. And that was one of the non-POG moments of the Giro for me, really. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, what his kind of progression is year on year, especially with the move to Soudal Quickstep from Decathlon, and whether, you know, they might be able to put a bit more weight behind him when it comes to...
He could definitely do with a bit more weight behind him.
Well, I know. He's made for GC racing, isn't he, and climbing. So we'll see. It'll be really interesting to see whether he steps on a level this May when he lines up for the Giro.
Interesting contrast as well. Well, Rob will come on to Valencia shortly, but interesting contrast, I suppose, in the fortunes of him and another young, very lithe French rider. In the last few days, Eleni Martinez rode in Valencia and wasn't quite as impressive. In dispatches, I suppose, from Oman, Lionel, you mentioned Olaf Coy. Kian Uttebroeks as well he was in the mix today, and a pretty credible performance from him. Of course, he had a rotten second half, in particular to last year. He'd been suffering with sort of nerve problems that it took a long time to diagnose. He said now that he's got to the bottom of what those problems were. And again, another rider coming out of the winter with high hopes for the coming season. But he's not going to do any grand tours this year. But he did give an interview to L'Equipe the other day in which he said he made no bones about the fact that, as far as he's concerned, he's the guy that Visma Lisabike are counting on to succeed Jonas Vingegaard. What did we decide he was? The Kendrick Lamar of professional cycling. Whenever he decides to or is forced to abdicate as the Visma Lisabike leader. I mean, that's many years away, isn't it?
I think I saw in the Flemish press or in the Dutch press earlier this week, they were talking about Project White Jersey, weren't they, and giving the younger riders an opportunity again. And I think the leadership had recognised that in the quest for excellence in the last couple of years at the very top, looking for yellow jerseys and leaders' jerseys in the biggest races, winning them more often than not, certainly until last year, they'd maybe admitted they'd forgotten a little bit about developing the next generation of talent and giving them chances, given the fact that they'd had young riders with them who'd then gone on to other teams to get their own opportunities. So I think giving people like Kian Uttebroeks opportunities in 1 week stage races to try and learn to win is the way they see that going.
Yeah, it's interesting that the kind of the burst onto the scene, a very young rider. I mean, he's still only 21. He'll be 22 at the end of this month, but it's quite interesting that the kind of the the curve, the ups and downs of a young rider's development, and maybe a year off Grand Tours will enable him to go forward. It might not necessarily do him any harm to have a year where he's able to perhaps be a bigger factor in the week-long stage races, take on a bit of leadership responsibility and kind of, you know, ride alongside Jonas Vingegaard as and when, and see whether any opportunities come his way without having to really sort of, you know, work to a team plan, because obviously Vingegaard will be riding any of those shorter races as preparation rather than with overall victory at the forefront of his mind.
Before we
move
on, chaps, can I, sorry.
No, Rob, no, Ed Brooks was fifth, just for housekeeping. Ed Brooks was fifth on that stage, Daniel. Fifth in GC, and for anyone who likes their numbers, that was a 30th career win for Adam Yates.
Can I, before we move on, mention another young rider, young Larry Warbass, 34 summers young, I think.
Is he still
33.
Eligible for the white jersey?
And I'm not going to, I'm not going to mention Larry Warbass in connection with the now long-running Escape Collective cycling podcast beef, a sort of Kendrick Lamar, Drake type scenario. Larry has been riding very well in Oman. He finished 18th on general classification, was also doing fine job positioning some of his teammates, soared in the general classification day up 11 places. Larry, in case you're wondering, we will be having Larry back on the pod. He doesn't know this yet, but in the next couple of weeks, to find out how things have been going and get a progress report on him securing that lovely Tudor timepiece. For me, at some point between now and the end of the season. Other racing news. Rob, I mentioned already that you were commentating on a race in Spain. Mm. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, Volta a la Comunidad Valenciana, 76th edition. It started really nicely, actually, down in Orihuela, right on the border with Murcia. An old Spanish rider named Bernardo Ruiz, 100 years old last month, from Orihuela. He was at the start. A Spanish cycling hero post-Civil War, actually. He came along before Bahamontes, before sort of being a late rival, then managing him and famously not getting on with him. But he won Vuelta a España, stage at the Tour as well. But he was there to see Lidl Trek win a team time trial. Their first team time trial win in over a decade. And it was a really strong team to do it. They had four national champions out of the seven riding along doing that. They didn't really have a big GC name, but they took, obviously, the first yellow jersey with young Matthias Vatsek. He then held on brilliantly the day after as he went high up to Al Puente. Beautiful finish in the mountains in Valencia there. Santiago Buitrago winning ahead of Peyo Bilbao, his teammate. Vatsek just holding on. The next day, well, we had another really, really big, big moment for Movistar, because they've been racing really well at the start of this season, haven't they? Ivan Romeo, who we saw winning the under-23 time trial champion last September, he went away with about 17Ks to go. But Movistar have been attacking all week. They've been sending riders off the front, their new signing, Jefferson Cepeda. That's the Caja Rural Cepeda, not the EF Education Easy Post Cepeda. And he'd been attacking as well. Who else had been having a go? A couple of other riders have been having a go. But Ivan Romeo brought it home. Brilliant win. First pro win for him in the seniors. Still, Vatsek was there or thereabouts fighting, but he'd had a crash early on the day. So the yellow jersey then passed to João Almeida. 2 days to go. One GC day remaining. We think it's all coming together and Almeida's going to be up there, but no. The final 1 kilometre climb with Jonathan Milan holding on to maybe win a really... Well, it would have been a massively unexpected sprint, wasn't it? Because there was basically GC guys in the group and Jonathan Milan and one lead-out man. Milan went ahead. He couldn't keep pace with his lead-out man. Buitrago rode away from everybody like he was Tadej Pogacar. João Almeida left down the bottom. Yellow jersey lost from his shoulders and Buitrago taking a second win of the week, securing really, with the last day being a sprint, his first ever GC title. So a massive moment for Santiago Buitrago. And the final stage, well, it was easy. Looked easy on paper. It looked even easier when you saw it on the video, didn't it? Jonathan Milan, I don't think he will ever have an easier sprint win than that in Valencia.
Milan was certainly one of the men of the week, was he not, Rob? You mentioned that performance with his teammate, Söderqvist, the young Swedish rider, time trialist, ruler, behind. Those two finished behind Buitrago on what turned into what on paper was just a sort of hilly, kind of undulating day. So much so that, in fact, Little Trek had sort of worked for the sprint finish to keep everything together. But as you mentioned, Rob, we ended up with a climbers group, really, and it wasn't anything even resembling a bunch sprint, and yet Milan still almost managed to hang on and win that stage. But it got me sort of thinking about Milan and what he might be able to do in the next few weeks, particularly with a view to Milan San Remo. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that we'd had a bit of a press call with Milan, a few Italian journalists and I, and asked him about Milan San Remo. And of course, last year he did it, but he had a very specific job and very sort of limited ambitions. He was there mainly for Mads Pedersen, and his job was to position Pedersen or to get to the bottom of the Poggio. No question of him going for the victory. Then at the Giro d'Italia, a few weeks later, a couple of months later, we had a bit of a sort of Milan San Remo kind of tribute facsimile sort of stage, obviously much, much shorter, but a stage that went over the Capi, and Milan won on that day. And just looking at the way he's come into this season, thinking about what his objectives are further down the line, first Tour de France appearance, I do wonder about Milan San Remo, particularly in the week when our friend, colleague Daniel Benson asked Mads Pedersen what his most controversial cycling opinion was. And Mads Pedersen said, Milan San Remo is a shit race. I think Pedersen is still going to be riding Milan San Remo. Of course, he's had a sort of turbulent relationship with Milan San Remo for many years. He skipped it most of the time. But was last year the first year he actually did have a go, Rob? Or there have been a couple of years now.
That rings a bell, actually. If I have to think back to my many pages and notes and stuff like that, I'm pretty sure I've had that one written down somewhere. It's funny, I think he maybe feels the pressure because that's the one everyone's expecting him to really have a go at as well, isn't it? It's one of the ones that people think that he should be able to win if things go right for him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Shades of Bernardino, of course, who used to call Paris-Roubaix a bullshit race, or he did at least once anyway, and then he famously won. And then famously never rode it again, except he did.
Oh, good correction. Oh my God. I was on the trigger there.
It was like Clint Eastwood was on the other end of the line.
Just he about, was
reaching,
yeah.
Reaching for his holster.
Erroneous 1980s cycling history. And I'm there. I was ready to shoot that one down. Jonathan Milan, will he have to change his name to Jonathan Pavia? Because Milan San Remo is starting in Pavia this year, isn't it? And for the next few years, I think. Did it last year? Was it last year that it moved
there? It did start in Pavia last year.
Yeah, I've started. Do you know what, chaps? I've done this before. I've gone down this rabbit hole before. In the name of nominative determinism, I've looked for an occasion where a rider has won a stage finishing or starting in a destination which is identical to their name. And I've never found one, certainly not in a big race.
Well, this could be the first, or maybe he'll have to change his name by whatever the Italian equivalent of deed poll is. If he does manage to win it one day, Jonathan Sanremo. I can see Ciro's headline on La Gazzetta dello Sport already.
Just one other thing, fellas, that I wanted to mention from Valencia was João Almeida. We just talked about David Goudou's relinquishing the leader's jersey in Oman. João Almeida looked pretty handily placed in spite of a not particularly great UAE performance in the team time trial, or certainly compared to Little Trek, and that left them facing a bit of a struggle. But Almeida did get his hands on the leader's jersey, but then was caught out, Rob, wasn't he? Caught out particularly by Buitrago, had his bib shorts pulled down a little bit. And it's not the first time that João Almeida has had this issue. When things get fiddly, when things get technical, when things get sort of undulating, and the emphasis is placed on explosive riding, but particularly placement, he has struggled, and there are no signs at the moment, certainly based on last week, that he's any closer to resolving this problem.
No, there was a tricky running, wasn't it? It was up and down, windy, narrow roads, right into that final kilometre, I think the 1 kilometre to go-kart was right at the bottom of the climb, if memory served me right from the other day. There was a little kink in the road, wasn't there? And the racing had been on for quite a long time. What was there, 20, 30 riders left? And Buitrago seemed to follow the wheels better. Either that or he had help better, because remember, Pello Bilbao was with him as well. And Almeida, it shocked me to see that he hasn't won a stage race, general classification, for 4 years now almost. 2021 was the last time he won. One thing I will say is he's going to be the local hero next week in the Volta Algarve. That ends with an uphill time trial finish to Moyal this year. They've changed that stage. But he's also going to be up against Jonas Vingegaard and Primož Roglič. So we're going to see how he gets on amongst the very, very big boys there. But you imagine a final stage like that is much more suited to him than the usual approach to Moyal, which is, of course, very, very technical and can get pretty messy that stage, can't it?
Last thing before we conclude the part, quick fire question. Who is more likely to win a Grand Tour stage this year? Which Colombian, Buitrago or Bernal?
Oh,
it's close, isn't it? It's close. I've talked a lot in the last few months about the sudden downturn in fortunes for Colombian cycling, but it was a really good weekend for them with Buitrago and Bernal. I think Bernal was going to win a stage of the Giro, but I also think Buitrago could win a stage in the Tour. So anyway...
So the first will be Bernal then, on the basis that he's riding the Giro.
Yes, okay.
There we are.
Let's end this part there.
Well, before we discuss Étoile de Passage, chaps, just got a few things to mention. Our very good friend and friend of the podcast and very dear friend of our co-host, co-founder, and our dear friend Richard Moore, Charlotte Elton, is crowdfunding to spray some graffiti on the road at Gent Wevelgem in tribute of Richard. She did this last year, but unfortunately the TV cameras didn't actually pick it up because they focused on the windmill at the top of the Banyaberg instead of the graffiti on the road. So I think she's got a bit of intel on where to spray her tribute onto the road. And she has crowdfunded because you're allowed to spray the paint on the road as long as it is environmentally friendly and it dissolves away in a couple of weeks. And so she has to buy special paint to do this. And so she funded it last year, but she's asked for a bit of help this year. We've contributed. In fact, she's met the target for the cost of the paint, and all additional money raised will be donated to Sir Chris Hoy's Tour de Four charity, which I think everyone will agree is a fantastic cause as well. If anyone would like to donate, I will mention this in this week's edition of the 1101 Cappuccino, our regular Substack that goes out to anyone who has subscribed to it. You can also find it online by just searching the 1101 Cappuccino on Substack, and you can read all of the previous editions. You can sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. A couple of other things to mention. An episode of the cycling podcast Feminam will be coming any day now, recorded by Rose Manley, Denny Gray, and I believe Orla Shenoui is back on the mic this month. So listen out for that. And a plug for The Cannibal and Badger, our deliberately, unashamedly lo-fi antidote to the maelstrom of social media. It's our virtual pub where people can discuss cycling. Currently, it's quite a... quite a sparsely attended bar. Maybe we've got the drink selection wrong, Daniel. I don't know. But we're going to try and generate a bit of discussion over the coming weeks, especially as we edge towards Omloop Het Nieuwsblad and the proper start of the season. I'll start a few topics. One thing that I thought of was you can ask us anything. Ask us anything in the Cannibal and Badger, and we will answer. With all caveats and disclaimers applied.
Lots of caveats and lots of caveats.
You can ask anything. You can ask anything and we will reply to the ones we want to reply to. Another, something that a listener, Greg Tomlinson, wrote in this week, which tickled me. We were talking last week about the idea of cycling teams having American sports style nicknames. And I mentioned the Unibet Rockets, and he said, did they miss a trick by not naming themselves the Unibet Sprockets? Now, Daniel's distaste for wordplay, I can see he's already unimpressed, but I like that. The Unibet Sprockets, yes, why not? Thank you, Greg.
I mean, you say I have a distasteful wordplay. You are talking about the man who came up with the title. What was it? What was the Rolf Aldag episode before the tour and before the before
so
Christmas.
Memorable you can't remember it.
True Rolf, the Red Bull Rein, R-E-I-G-N idea.
Extraordinary,
Rolf,
extraordinary wordplay.
Rein idea.
Not on Patron, never mind the Balearics, which was my Mallorca series. I mean, I think everyone can agree that was absolutely fantastic wordplay. Thanks to everyone, by the way, who showered Rob and I in praise for that series. Really happy with how it turned out, and glad to hear that so many people have been enjoying it. Even though the race is over, if you haven't listened to it, it's on our free feed. Thanks to our sponsorship from Sports Tours International. Shall we crack on with the next part, the final part of this episode, Daniel?
Yes. Well, we've mentioned races in Oman and Spain. There was another stage race taking place last week. A stage race with a pretty appetizing, mouthwatering start list. Some big names in the south of France. The Étoile de Bessèges. Where does this take place, Lionel? Give people a rough geolocation.
Oh, well, it's in the Gard region. I mean, basically you fly into Marseille and drive northwestish a bit, don't you, inland?
Yeah.
And it tends to be, my only experience of visiting that race was beautifully clear skies and incredibly cold, I remember. I don't know whether it's like that this year, but...
If you drive, I would say, about 100 kilometres west of Mont Ventoux, you will be in the Gard and in this neck of the woods. Étoile de Bessèges, we'll talk a bit about its history as an event shortly, I think. But the main events, or the main event that got people talking, stage one was won by Paul Magnier of Soudal Quickstep. And then on stage two, already I should say that there were more anecdotal reports of safety issues on stage one. Cars driving onto the course or coming in the opposite direction to the race. Stage two, however, was very much marred by one particular incident of a vehicle driving onto the course and causing a crash in the peloton. A crash that cost Maxime Van Gils, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe's star new signing for 2025, injuries which had to be treated in hospital. He was rushed to hospital. Lots of angry riders, understandably so. Lots of consternation. So much so, there was a meeting before stage three. There were demands that the situation improved. There were assurances, supposedly, from the race organisers. However, the problem arose again, I believe, 9 kilometres into stage three. More vehicles on the course, and the race was neutralised after 17 kilometres of racing. And then one of these sort of impromptu meeting, I think meeting would maybe be too dignified a term to use, certainly based on some of the anecdotal reports of sort of voices being raised and insults being traded, but some kind of conflag broke out on the race, on the road, around the race, and the net result of this was that shortly thereafter, Soudal Quickstep, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, Decathlon, AG2R La Mondiale, EF Education, EasyPost, Uno X Mobility all withdrew their riders en masse. There were a couple of other teams who withdrew most of their riders. I should add Ineos, actually, to that. Ineos, I was watching sort of live commentary, text commentary of the race, and Ineos weren't initially said to have abandoned, but they did. There were a couple of other teams who were sort of caught in confusion, particularly the Unibet Tietema team. We just mentioned them. This team is sort of born out of a YouTube channel in the Netherlands a couple of years ago, and as of this year is racing with a French license. And almost comically, tragicomically, they ended up pulling out of the race, supposedly, not because they wanted to, because they had misunderstood some instructions over race radio in French. And the order was sort of given, and we'll get to how it was given maybe in a minute, that the race was going to resume. They didn't get the message, and they had pulled out by this point. Also, Lotto, whose rider Arnaud Delis actually won the stage, they sort of pulled out but didn't. Lionel.
Well, two riders carried on, didn't they?
Yes.
Arnaud Delis, of course, and Baptiste Vestroffer was his teammate who they chose to stay.
Yes.
But the rest of the team pulled out.
Yes. And so a very depleted peloton finally did resume the race on stage three. Arnaud Delis won the stage. And that was Friday, was it not? Anyway, that evening, the UCI said they had opened an investigation into cars on the race route during stage two and three and suggested that measures were being taken to avoid a repetition of the dangers. The race did proceed stages four and five. It was won overall by Kevin Vauclin, who finished second in 2024. He went one better this year. He was the pre-race favourite. A very timely, important victory for Arkea B&B Hotels because, of course, as discussed in the podcast over the last few weeks, they're very much in a relegation fight. There are other teams who are very much in a relegation fight who, as you would probably have expected, predicted, stayed on at the Étoile de Bessèges. And, we can question why they stayed on. There were French team. I mean, I'm talking about Cofidis, I'm talking about Arkea, both of those two teams, French, and in desperate need of points. But chaps, there are lots of layers to this. There was some very good reporting about it. Daniel Benson was there. Direct Vélo, the French website, did some excellent reporting on it, and particularly that hour when the race on stage three was sort of at a standstill. I mentioned insults being traded. There were three riders union representatives on the race: Dries De Bont of AG2R La Mondiale, Benjamin Thomas of Cofidis, and Oyer Lascano of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. Lascano was firmly in the camp of those who wanted to, and this, I should specify this. There was a group of riders, a cohort of riders and teams who were lobbying for or wanted stage three to be cancelled. Not the race, not the whole race. They were told, at least according to the reporting by the organisers, that if they pulled out of stage three, then the race would end. Whether that was a threat, emotional blackmail, you can make your own mind up. Talking of emotional blackmail, there was also talk of other threats from the organisers that if they pulled out now, A, the race might not happen next year, or B, those particular teams would not be invited back at any point in the future. So Lascano definitely wanted the race to, on that particular day, stage three, to stop. Benjamin Thomas, he tried to argue that the incident on stage three had been caused by a driver who had simply not listened to instructions from the police. The police in this case were there. They were blocking the junction in question, and this particular driver had been told three times they needed to stop and they ignored the advice. And Benjamin Thomas said, look, the organizers can't legislate for this kind of thing. We need to sort of be a little bit flexible here in the name of saving this race, a race that I think Lionel, you're going to tell us a little bit in a second. Doesn't have a particularly long history, but it's certainly seen as one of those sort of independent, kind of rootsy, home run, homespun, you might say, French races, which sort of enrich the tapestry of this sport, which is not all about, you know, it's not all about oil money and world tour and multi-million pound budgets. It's also about events like this that rely to a large extent, particularly in the case of Étoile de Bessèges, on volunteers.
Yeah, I mean, the race was founded in 1971. I mean, I should just say, for those who aren't that familiar, Étoile de Bessèges basically means the Star of Bessèges, doesn't it? And it's around the town of Bessèges and into the countryside there. It's one of those traditional training races. The South of France used to be one of the centres of the early season. I'm talking sort of 70s, 80s and into the 90s. A lot of those races have just completely disappeared. You know, the Tour of the Mediterranean, the Grand Prix Cannes used to be one that was sort of along the coast from Nice to Alassio. You know, there were lots of stage races, one-day races, and the teams really turned up to these races after their sort of skiing training camps, and they kept the same clothing on for the week, really, didn't they? They wore the long johns and the winter gloves and the winter hats, and it all got a bit more serious in the 90s, I guess, and the race, the Étoile de Bessèges, it is a race run effectively by small company and volunteers. You know, it's kind of evolved out of a cycling club type background. You talked about the unity there between the riders, you know, wanting the stage to be cancelled and perhaps resuming on stage four. I was in Mallorca a couple of weeks ago, and of course one of the races was cancelled, and there was complete unity among the riders there because of the structure of the event. They could afford to cancel and pull out en masse, knowing that they weren't jeopardising race four and race five. Whereas this is a traditional stage race, a more common stage race, where the general classification is only open to riders who complete all of the stages, of course. Once you're out, you're out. And so I think that was probably what led to this sort of fracture. And we see it, don't we? The teams that can kind of afford to go, leave, I mean, you know, Soudal, Ineos, Lidl, Red Bull, you know, the big teams, they pulled out. We see Lotto kind of in the middle. They had something to gain. You know, Arnaud Delis won the stage, despite the rest of his teammates, other than one teammate who stayed with him. They all pulled out. And the teams that survived were the French teams and all of the smaller teams for whom an invite to the Étoile de Bessèges will be a big part of their season. I think the first thing to say is that these races are at a kind of tipping point, aren't they? We've got all of this kind of groundswell of change coming, with the idea that perhaps, you know, the one cycling branded calendar is going to lead to fewer but bigger events. And I think these smaller events are going to find themselves in a very difficult situation, where either they bring their safety standards up, significantly up in some cases, which is going to cost a lot of money, or these races go to the wall. And then the sport and the big teams will have to work out whether they actually desire preparation style races for the bigger events that are to come. I think we're at a kind of point where there's going to be a bit of a reckoning about what does the calendar need to look like from the point of view of the big teams, and is there any place for the small and medium-sized teams who, you know, are the launching pad for, you know, riders who may well move on to the big teams. You know, these races do have a function. They're important insofar as they go. You know, they provide racing experience for smaller teams and riders. They provide an opportunity to sort of get into race shape for the bigger teams and riders. The question will be whether the big teams would miss races like this. It's clear that without the big teams, these events won't survive anyway. But the point is, the real kind of black line is that rider safety is paramount, and a car pulling onto the course is just not acceptable. You know, it's never been acceptable, but it's been tolerated. And I think we've got to a point now where it's not going to be tolerated anymore. I mean, I've been at small races, both here in the UK and in Europe, where, you know, the police or the outriders come along and they tell somebody who wants to pull off their driveway to wait there, there's a bike race coming, and they simply ignore them. And when the motorcycle outrider or police officer is away, the car will pull out. And if there's a crowd, they'll shout, whoa, 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 you know, stop, there's a race coming. And it goes back to what I was saying a couple of weeks ago about the goodwill that exists between the communities where these races take part, the local authorities where the races take part, the police, who's getting paid, how much it's costing. And I suppose when I look at the influx of cash that might come from one cycling, maybe that would be one use for it, to have a tier of preparation races and pump all of that money into making these races safer.
It's funny, actually, you talk about people stopping cars there. It makes me think straight away about getting the train to the Flemish Classics. There's always somebody with their very proud gilet and uniform and little flag. And there's so many volunteers that keep those races safe, as well as the police forces. Daniel, going back to what you were talking about with the chaos before, I spoke to Matty Breschel this week on the Gruppetto to try and get some sort of inside view on it, and he said that at one stage they were told the race was cancelled. You know, it's like the commissaires couldn't decide. So maybe that's where the confusion for people like the Tietemar Rockets came from. I think Lionel, you referred to the Spanish race last week when you were here in Mallorca. I've been reading the paper again this week, and the organizer of that race, he's still kicking off at the riders. There's so much disconnect in maybe what some of these smaller organizers think should be, is safe, and what now the riders, thankfully that they've got more of a voice, know is safe. So there's that disconnect that needs bringing together. I have quite a hard opinion on this, and I think it's probably been hardened by, unfortunately, having to try and find words for things that are pretty horrendous. You know, tragedies we've had on the road, fatalities, all sorts of things that we just should not happen when someone goes out to practice sport. I said this again the other day in a little monologue I gave on the Gruppetto, but I'll repeat it now. And it is possible to feel sorry for organisers, isn't it? And want these races and this history continue. And that's why your suggestion, Lionel, there of filtering the money down, because it does come down to money, doesn't it? You have to pay for extra people. You have to pay for the police force. I think they were saying on the French radio last week that the cost of gendarmes in the last 15 to 20 years has gone up by something like 2,000%. It is not cheap. And these small races, as you said, quite rightly, Lionel, do not make any money. They all just do it for the love of the sport and for continuing this wonderful tradition. But at the same time, as well as feeling sorry for that history and wanted it to continue, you said it, safety is paramount. You know, we should never compromise when it comes to safety, livelihoods, lives. The worst possible outcome for the organisers, and it's sad, but they will lose the race. The worst possible outcome for the riders is that somebody lose their life. And that is the perspective, I think, that we really need here.
Yeah, it does feel like a reckoning is about to happen, or is maybe already happening. There are changes, obviously, in both cycling and society at large, which impose changes upon the way these races, or should impose changes upon the way these races are run. You chaps mentioned funding being squeezed. I mean, this has been a big topic of conversation in France, but I think it is in lots of places. There was an open letter from professional sports people published by Le Parisien newspaper just a few weeks ago, complaining about how the French state had cut funding by €273 million for sport. And this on the back of the Paris Olympics, which cost an awful lot of money. But there is a feeling everywhere that there is less and less money available. I was listening yesterday to a French podcast, RMC's cycling podcast, where Jérôme Pinot, the former rider, former team manager, he was talking about how volunteers once upon a time, you know, they would get a little gift, for example, if they did come and work on races. There isn't even money for that anymore. Just practically as well, just in terms of world tour races versus other kinds of races and the way cycling has evolved, changed. Racing, as anyone who sort of followed the sport 15, 20 years ago, used to look very different. Often it did used to look like a procession for the first three quarters of stages of races. Now that's no longer the case. The spectacle is maybe enhanced, but last week at Bessèges, we had, again, anecdotal reports about motorbikes, police motorbikes, not even being able to move up alongside the peloton because the riders themselves were spread across the road and they were already racing in the first hour. So that's changed. We had a rider last week, Søren Varenskold of X Mobility, talking about how maybe at the level under the World Tour, 0.1 category races, we should only be having circuit races now. Which are much easier to secure. You know, 20-kilometer circuit, there are maybe 50 junctions rather than, I don't know how many junctions have to be closed off in a sort of typical point-to-point 180-kilometer stage, but it might be, you know, it's hundreds. That might be a solution as well. Other practical considerations, you know, I just looked up some statistics earlier. There are 10 million more cars on the road in France than there were 20 years ago. That plays a role. Races tend to finish at sort of 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. That's when people are going to pick up their kids from school or returning from work.
An issue last week in Mallorca, actually. Lionel and I were speaking about it. A friend of mine is a teacher at the school around the corner. They had to change the chucking out time because of it.
Yeah. So, you know, there are things that can be done on a practical level, but there are other areas, there are other sort of aspects of this which look as though they might be unwinnable battles. Chaps, I propose, Rob, you mentioned earlier you spoke to Matty Breschel for your Le Gruppetto, do we call it? The Gruppetto, your show.
Certainly not with a French accent, but not.
On YouTube. I mentioned that Little Trek were another team that pulled out of the race. Their direct sportif at the Étoile de Bessèges was Steven de Jong, former rider, of course. I spoke to Steven earlier today about his experience last week at the Étoile de Bessèges. Let's hear from him.
As the years passed by, I think traffic got worse and security got more and more in conflict. The last few years, already stage one was a topic because there's always been like trucks parked bad on the road and so on. Last year, stage one was luckily cancelled because of the strikes of the farmers. So this year, this stage two, unfortunately, there was a lot of traffic this year, and we decided to stop because it was not safe enough. Let's put it simple. I think everybody saw the footage of the car driving towards the peloton. And then, we asked for better or more security on stage three. But then after 12 kilometers, two cars, one entered and one just barely stopped. And that was the drip, no? Of the bucket to be full. So unfortunately, then we left. But we had no other... I would say that solutions.
I mentioned your career and you riding in Bessèges at the end of the 90s, but generally when you're in the car as a sports director, over the last few years, the last 10 years, say, at these slightly smaller races, have you noticed a bit of a trend, or have you had the sense that these small race organizers are struggling more and more to make their races safe, probably because of the financial pressures that they're under?
Yes, unfortunately, yes. And with the people getting more impatient, just in general, I think it's harder to do. Like in the past, you could block off a crossing and maybe leave in advance of the peloton coming. And tell the car driver there, no, when the green flag has passed, you can go. But nowadays, that's not good enough anymore. I think you have to have people there, stopping the peloton. And when the peloton is passed and the caravan is passed, then you can leave and open up the traffic again. But this is what they do in a lot of races, and also where they put out the ribbons, to really physically block the crossings, and the motor drivers behind picking up the ribbons and opening up traffic again. I think that is almost now, it needs to be done. Otherwise, people will not wait and they will go on the road.
Another thing that's been mentioned is how racing has changed. And okay, this wasn't a World Tour race, but it's a very strong field, and a lot of people who were there and who have been there over the last few years have said it's raced almost like a World Tour race. And what does that mean? Well, it means that you no longer have the two quiet hours and then a very fast finale. And this changes the dynamics of the bunch, and it changes how the race has to be policed. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that. And then, when you have the meeting in front of the race, the police is asking the bunch to let the motor drivers pass. But if there's a parcours where that is not possible, because, the peloton, if they're racing on a smaller road, it's not so easy to let the motor guys or let the motor drivers pass. And they also have to race for the finale, no? So at one point, you have to say, okay, if the motor drivers cannot pass the peloton anymore, okay, it's not going to be safe. So there has to be more police to guide them in that last hour. And I think it's not to blame the riders there to say, yeah, but it's their own fault because they don't let the motor police pass. I think that doesn't make sense. If they're riding on roads which are very, very twisty, or they are narrow, and everybody is fighting for position because it's the final. Then you cannot blame the riders for not letting the police the motor drivers pass. I think that is not good enough anymore.
We know a bit about the way the race organizers reacted, and they're obviously very emotional, and this is an emotional subject as well for them, because the founder of the race died a few years ago and the race has been inherited by his daughter. So without talking about them, I was just going to ask you about the UCI and the role the UCI has in all of this. Obviously, after the events of last week, they put out a communique saying they would investigate. We don't know what the result.
Well, I'm disappointed in UCI, to be honest, because when they sent out the communique that evening, it just stated there was nothing to mention about the whole state. So basically, the riders there, they were protesting for almost an hour, and then when we had the email in the evening, the communique of the jury just said, no, nothing to report. Basically, that was it. So that's pretty poor, in my opinion. They stopped the race here in the Pyrenees a couple of years ago with the women, where safety was a topic. So they stopped the whole race. I think they should have stopped the race also this year. But that's my opinion. I think if there's 3 days in a row, if there's cars on the road, I think the UCI should have said, listen, we're not going to finish the stage. We are going to look for a solution for stage four to make it safer, or we're going to race now on a circuit or whatever. But in my opinion, they should have stopped the race, at least mentioned something in the communique that something happened. There will never be a united decision in between the teams or the riders. This will never happen. I also stated a quote on my Instagram, on the stories, that I said the only time you will have a united bunch, teams united and riders united, that's unfortunately when somebody died and they have 1 minute silence.
Mm.
There's so many, different opinions.
Yeah, and competing interests as well. Because obviously, last week, we had teams who were fighting for survival in the UCI rankings. We had French teams. Yeah. We had teams with an emotional link to the family that runs the race, and so on and so on. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really hard. And at the end of the day, when I'm a sport director, I'm at the race, I called to our manager. I said, Luca, it's crazy. I said, it's the third day in a row we have traffic on the road. And he basically said, Steven, I back your decision. If you turn around to go back to the bus, I back that decision. It's crazy. So I'm really happy for that, because I was saying to the guys, we go back to the bus. We are stick with the big teams here, and we go back to the bus, because in the end of the day, we have to make the phone call to the wife or to the girlfriend and saying, hey, shit, your husband or your friend got hit by a car who went on the road.
Mm.
And I never want to make that call, to be honest. And I think if the UCI can see that it's 3 days in a row, there's a conflict with safety, they have to take that decision, I think. It's not up to the teams to let them do, because there will never be, one voice from them.
No.
Even not from the riders, It's a hard decision. But if you see on how many terms we should all fulfill to get the World Tour license, and then organizers struggling with safety or with financial,
obligations.
Terms. Yeah. Obligations to pay prize money or whatsoever, the team should always help them to survive. And I think that is not good enough. If, we are there to help them, we are there to think with them, but if the safety at the day is not in place, I think we cannot help them anymore. More that we do, we come to that race, we come with a strong lineup, we want to race. But if our riders are in danger, I think we cannot continue to race, because we pay them too much money to race them on unsecure roads. And if something happens, it's bad for them, but it's really bad for us as well. And the worst is for the family if something happens.
Well, chaps, it feels as though this is going to be a big issue that we're going to be discussing a lot this year, because as I say, it feels as though a reckoning, if it's not already happening, is nigh for the whole sport.
I mean, I think the suggestion from Soren Wernerskold, and I've heard it from other people as well, you know, circuit races, thinking a bit more about the design of courses, you know, that may well have to be the solution. Shorter races, perhaps, some of these preparation races, you know, it could be that all aspects of these races have to be rethought. But there does have to be a kind of joined up thinking between what the World Tour or whatever it's eventually going to be ends up being. You know, the classics and the Grand Tours are the things that are sort of set in stone, even for, you know, the great disruptors and the great modernizers. I think that they're going to be reluctant to sort of really alter the identity of the biggest races, but probably everything else is up for grabs and up for a bit of discussion, and perhaps it's time for a bit of brainstorming. I'd like to see some public brainstorming from the people who are actually driving the change, so that it isn't a case of something just being foisted upon the fans, the watching public, you know, at short notice. It would be great to get an idea of what the thinking is. How do these people think the sport is going to look in a decade's time? And then we can kind of get used to it before it comes along.
In terms of making, again, safety standards much more uniform and better, I'd love to see, I've said it before, I'd say it again, I would love to see the governing body actually govern. There's a lot of talk about rules, and I went last year to a commentators conference. I was left rather frustrated. A couple of other commentators and a few ex-riders, you know, they've certainly had much more skin in the game. And we just kept getting told, no, well, we can give these directives, we can set what we think it is, but it's the responsibility of the organisers. I think, no, if you are a government, you have to govern. And that is the job here of UCI, not just fining people, but helping people. Because, of course, I think it's to their benefit and on the whole sport's benefit if we can make things safer and, naturally, keep that history as well as adding to it as well in the future. So I would love to see a bit more active involvement from the governing body on this.
Any other business, chaps?
Well, just before we go, Daniel, I spoke to Christian Rumu of Amnesty International last week about the UCI World Championships taking place in Rwanda. It was an item in the Musette of News last week. I'm just going to keep saying it until it's the law. But unfortunately, it wasn't the greatest connection, and it would be difficult to hear. And I, obviously, in having a conversation with Christian, I was able to sort of go back and reiterate the points, but unfortunately, unable to play the audio. But he did make some really interesting points. And added to my kind of understanding of this thorny issue, he is a campaigner for Amnesty International, specializes in East and Southern Africa. And he outlined the situation in Rwanda. You know, the crux of the matter is that there is no right or freedom of association and expression. Effectively, the government controls what you do and say, who you associate with. There's evidence of people being held without trial. There's obviously the conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo, just over the border, which the UN maintains involves Rwanda-backed armed forces. And his opinion was that Rwanda is hosting the UCI Road Race Championships this year in order to project a rosy image of the country to the world, sports washing, effectively. Now, whenever we talk about sports washing, we also get a kind of whataboutery, don't we? You know, people will say, well, yes, but what about Saudi Arabia? Yes, but what about this team sponsor or that team sponsor? And there's validity to that. But I think the consequence of whataboutery is that the net result is that everything kind of gets minimized or ignored, and we kind of gloss over all of the issues rather than focus on them. For want of a better word, there's a kind of a thought that cycling's gatekeepers are, you know, the Western world, Europe, North America, Australia. And there is a very valid point that hosting the World Championships in a country and a region outside of the traditional heartland is a good thing for the sport. And I think the takeaway I had from my conversation with Christian Rumu of Amnesty International was that he said that we should be able to hold two thoughts in our minds at the same time. we can think that it's fantastic that the world championships are being held in Africa for the first time, which is obviously true, but whilst also recognising that there are things that the Rwanda regime would prefer us to ignore. So, in effect, turn the business of hosting the world championships back on the Rwandan regime by not just sort of ignoring it, not glossing over the difficulties, and putting the two issues side by side rather than one in front of the other. And I thought that was a good way of looking at it, and I think I will endeavour to try to do that.
We'll be back next week.
All very serious there.
Extremely serious. Some would argue there's too much freedom of speech in this cycling podcast. we'll be back next week with a focus on goings on in Portugal and the Algarve, and a focus in particular on Jonas Vingegaard and his team Visma Lisa Bike. Until then, chaps, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Até logo.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.